Please be seated. The first case on the en banc court schedule today is Anthony Castaneda v. the State of Nevada, case number 64515. Counsel, please accept my apologies for commencing a little late. We were delayed, but we're off to the races now. So are you ready to go?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, please proceed.
Justices of the Supreme Court, Mr. Chief Justice, my name is David Westbrook. I'm from the Clark County Public Defender's Office. I represent Mr. Castaneda in this matter. I'd like to reserve, if I may, 5 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the Court, I will be starting with the rebuttal testimony. As you know, this was a long brief. There are 9 separate issues. There are literally dozens of errors that occurred in this case that warrant reversal all on their own, and of course in the cumulative. I'd like to start with the expert rebuttal testimony. As the Court is aware, there was new evidence that was put forward by Detective Ehlers at trial that was part of no prior statement, certainly not at the preliminary hearing where Detective Ehlers didn't even testify, nor in any kind of written report. We were never noticed of it, and we were surprised by it in trial. I think what's difficult to understand if one does not have a computer background is the actual import of what was said and why it's so important. So I'd like to use an analogy. A medical examiner in a murder case concludes that the cause of death is a gunshot wound to the head, but makes no conclusion as to whether it's a homicide or a self-inflicted wound. At trial, for the first time, despite having put it in no report, he says the wound was not self-inflicted, that someone else had to pull the trigger. Obviously, that goes to the ultimate issue in the case, number one, and number two, it's obviously brand new evidence that the defense would not have been prepared for. Obviously, in that sort of a case, we would get to bring in a rebuttal expert. Otherwise, why even bother having a trial? That's our case. That's this case. For the Detective Ehlers in this case to go forward based on the evidence that was presented and say that it proves that a human actor was involved goes to the ultimate issue in this case, which is knowledge and willfulness. The evidence easily suggested that it was an automated program that accessed files in this case. And for him to draw that conclusion was brand new evidence. I certainly wasn't expecting it, and we made the record thusly. We needed an expert in this case in order to counter that revelation, a revelation that did not appear in the 2 or so years that this case was active before trial. Ironically, the reason we didn't get the expert is because the district court judge said that the state would be prejudiced by the surprise. There are ways around that. First of all, we were prejudiced by the surprise because in their 21-day notice, they didn't say that there would be testimony regarding knowledge or intent or on a human actor causing changes in the files that were on this computer. So there was no notice. We were the ones that were surprised. And number two, there was a remedy the court never considered, a recess, a small delay in the trial so they can come up to speed. Instead, what she did was she applied selectively the rules of NRF 174.2342 and NRF 174.2343B. The state didn't disclose this expert's expected testimony, or conversely, they didn't know that he would actually say that. In one way, they violated the statute. In the other way, it's a surprise. Either way, we should get a rebuttal expert. We didn't have it, and it greatly prejudiced our case.
How do you square your argument with the Perez opinion, which was deeply divided? It divided this court pretty substantially, but that is an expert report on grooming and the inadequacy or alleged inadequacy of the state's disclosure with respect to what that guy was actually going to testify to. To my mind, I look at that precedent and lay it next to this case, and I'm struggling to see that this was any more deficient than that case. And I wonder, I marvel at it because my background's civil, so I look at, you know, a civil disclosure, you would expect a full-on report, and you would have had that access to that. But Perez seems to say you don't need that in criminal, which seems backwards, but
And honestly, I agree that it seems backwards. I'm constantly disheartened by the complete lack of discovery that we get in a criminal situation where people's lives are literally on the line. People can go to jail for the rest of their lives. They can even be killed, and yet we can't depose witnesses as a matter of right. We don't send interrogatories. It makes me extremely upset in certain cases, this being one of them.
Well, was the disclosure any less sufficient in this case than in Perez? And we have to follow that precedent. It's our precedent.
I understand, Your Honor, and this is different for a very good reason,
okay.
Because this was a comment on the ultimate fact in the case. When you're talking about grooming in a case, that's an opinion as to motive. You know, the state doesn't have to prove motive. What this is he's saying that there were some files that were sliced up without getting into technical details. Some of them were...
And the question was whether by human design or some sort of automated virus surgery, right?
Exactly. The state made no offer of proof. They didn't even try to prove in trial where these files came from and who downloaded them in the first place or when they were downloaded in the first place. There were some suggestions, but there was no offer of proof, and they didn't even try to prove that. Okay, no one prior to this trial claimed that these were evidence of a human actor. And the human action is the ultimate question in this case, because the state's theory is these were his computers. Therefore, proof of a human actor is proof that this man committed the crime. It's way different when you're talking about something like grooming, which provides a motive for the person committing the crime, as opposed to discussing the actual fact of the crime itself.
So you would distinguish Perez on the grounds it was less essential, it was not elemental?
Correct.
Okay.
Motive stuff is window dressing. This was the actual issue in the case because there was a stipulation, as the court is aware, that we agreed that this was child pornography. So we weren't trying to prove that these 15 images were child pornography or disprove it, as if that were our burden.
Right.
The only issue was whether it was knowing and willful, whether he had a specific intent to possess them, and then whether he actually did. The fact is they were basing, at trial, their conclusions that he did this because there were some carved files in the database. All right, that could happen through an automated program. But the conclusion that Detective Ellis put forth for the very first time was that a human had to have done this. It's very unlikely that it was automated.
What about the flash drive, though? Wouldn't a human... I mean, what was the testimony on the flash drive?
Well, Your Honor, he actually wasn't convicted of the things on the flash drive.
Okay.
He was convicted of the stuff on the computers.
Okay.
The flash drive brings up a very interesting question, and one of the other big issues in this case.
Well, I don't want to derail you. Keep going. I'm sorry.
But, yeah, obviously a human would have to put stuff on a flash drive. That's true, unless it's in the computer and there's some automated backup process that backed it up to a flash drive. That happened.
Yeah.
But, again, there's no evidence, and it's not our job to provide the evidence. It's the state's. That goes to our insufficiency of the evidence claim. But the only person that we know had the flash drive were two witnesses, one of whom perjured herself on the stand. The only person who we know possessed this child pornography were the two state witnesses, including Mr. Landau, who the other witness was lying to protect. We know they had the flash drive, and we know that a human actor was involved in downloading that stuff. We also know they did it, and they weren't charged because they blamed my client. It's a huge issue in this case, and this is a case that is completely based on a combination of supposition and outright perjury. And I can say the word perjury without any reservation because she admitted it on the stand, which is a very rare instance indeed. I'm afraid that perjury probably isn't incredibly rare at some trials. Someone admitting it is incredibly rare. It happened in this case, and yet there was no action from the district court on it. My client has a right to present his case and his theory of defense. We were presented with brand new information that had not been noticed in accordance with the statute prior to the trial. We were sideswiped with it.
Was there anything beyond, I'm sorry to keep pestering you, but was there anything beyond the notice of expert? There was the preliminary hearing testimony of Ramirez, and there was the notice of intent to call these two experts with a summary description. Was there any report at all? Like...
The only reports, Your Honor, were the factual reports of what was found on the database. My problem here is that there was a conclusion that this expert drew, Detective Ellers drew, based on the reports. A conclusion that, by the way, Detective Ramirez didn't entirely share.
But I'm talking about the disclosure of what Ellers and Ramirez were going to testify to. What was disclosed to your client before trial?
All that was disclosed was the generalities. They'll testify as an expert in computer forensics. and identify that child pornography was found on devices belonging to Mr. Castaneda.
So that was the notice of the disclosure, but there's no separate expert report that's not, I can't find it in the record.
There is no separate expert report saying what they would testify to. There were reports that were generated in the course of the investigation by these experts. You know, this is what we found on the computer. But there were no conclusions. And specifically, they are supposed to tell us what they're going to testify to. It's part of the statute. And that's not what they did. So we were the ones that were surprised. And yet the court denied us our ability to rebut this surprise with our own expert because they were afraid the state would be surprised. And that's selective use of the statute to favor the state and to deny my client his rights. That was the wrong thing to do, and he did not get a fair trial. He could not get a fair trial under those circumstances. It would be the same scenario as if a medical examiner went on the stand and then all of a sudden decided to start talking about the cause of death and a human actor being involved, identifying it as homicide instead of a self-inflicted wound for the first time. There is zero question that we would get an expert in that case, but we didn't. Unless there are specific questions regarding the lack of evidence in this case that I can answer, I know a lot of it is technical, then I'm going to skip that section, but this was not a case where it was proven beyond a reasonable doubt. I also have specific arguments about
the statutory construction issues.
Right, the statutory construction issues as well. But I think what it comes down to is Wilson's controlling, and it specifically encompassed this statute. It's not really a Jackson issue because we're not talking about two different statutes. We're talking about one statute. Fundamental fairness certainly comes into play. But in this case, we actually have something that's good law that covers this statute. That wasn't by accident. So there was only one possession.
Well, one of the argument on that, that to read it otherwise is to indulge an ambiguity against the defense?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's correct. I thought our jury instructions should have included specific intent, as was the ruling of this court in the Ford case. We didn't get that instruction. And all of the misconduct in this case. And we've had Justice Gibbons, Justice Cherry, and Justice Hardesty come to our office and talk to us about how to make a record. Offers of proof. Make objections that are contemporaneous. Someone in trial counted my objections during closing argument. I believe there were 25. 22 of which were overruled. Misstatements of the law, misstatements of the facts that we know are wrong, that even in their opposition brief, the state did not say that these were correct statements of the fact. They just said that they were opinions on what the facts are, that was A-OK. We also know that in this case that the jury was swayed by these misstatements of the facts because we talked to the jury, and I did get another offer of proof, a declaration of what happened, a declaration that was not challenged by the state. We know that this jury was affected by all the misconduct in this case. We were told to make a record. I took that to heart, and I made the longest, most complete, and accurate record that I could. The misconduct in this case swayed the case. The lack of an expert in this case on our part swayed the case, robbed my client of a fair trial. With that, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Okay, Mr. Fishberg. Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chin, I was going to start off by asking a disparaging counsel question that Mr. Westbrook raised, but I think I may shift to something that really concerns me, and it is the manner in which the district attorney's office presented some of their arguments by using the no evidence banner across a number of exhibits. I'm troubled by that, and let me tell you why. I know that you can comment that the evidence failed to show, but I'm not so sure that this PowerPoint presentation, the manner in which it was presented, is appropriate.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. We had a PowerPoint presentation in both, I believe, the closing and possibly the rebuttal as well. And I think per Evans v. State, I understand that the court is concerned by the fact that it said no evidence, but the fact of the matter is there was no evidence presented about the things that defense was concerned about.
I get that. I want to hear why it is that you believe that PowerPoint was appropriate.
Because I think the evidence showed, and those specific questions as to the PowerPoint presentation you're talking about, there were specific questions directed towards the state's experts that asked, did you look at certain things such as virus? Did you see anything unusual with regards to malware causing these problems? And both experts testified that that is something that they will routinely look to see if there's something that's strange or odd. And if they found something like that, they would go and pursue that leak. But I think what happened here was defense chose to characterize his statements, or defense attorney was making his statements almost like evidence. And per Rudin v. State, statements of the attorneys themselves are not evidence.
And neither is a PowerPoint with the banner "no evidence" across it.
I agree it's not evidence, but the testimony was specifically, was there these certain things, malware, was it due to virus?
I don't doubt that you can comment on that. My concern is the PowerPoint presentation itself. I believe that it is for the jury to determine the weight and the credibility of the evidence that is presented. And when someone uses this type of a banner, I'm concerned. I don't want to take up more of your time, but that's where my concern is. Not what the evidence showed or what you can argue the evidence showed, but the manner in which that presentation was made.
I understand that the manner is important. And I also think that counsel just brought up misstatements that happened throughout the trial. The counsel talked about things that the state did, for instance, that were improper. And as well, defense or the appellant in this case makes a comment about how one of the witnesses committed perjury by lying. Now, this was hashed out during the trial. We talked both about lies versus mistakes. But I just want to point out that in appellant's argument 1 moment ago, he mentioned specifically, he says, Detective Ehlers never testified at the preliminary hearing, and therefore he was surprised by what happened. And I point you exactly to Appellant's Appendix 1, page 67. It's the beginning of the preliminary hearing transcript for one Detective Paul Ehlers. And Detective Ehlers testified at the preliminary hearing. So just as Appellant has just misstated the preliminary hearing testimony, I want to point out that those type of comments about the state making these misstatements were happening continually throughout the trial by defense and have continued to even today's proceeding, where it's clear from the record that there was a preliminary hearing transcript from Detective Ehlers. Moreover, what's in that preliminary hearing transcript are all of the things that Detective Ehlers then testified to at the trial. He talked about creation dates, access dates, all of this computer lingo.
Is it fair to say that the issue of whether it was human design that created the remnant file that was found on the hard drive, and pardon me, I don't speak this lingo well either, but that was elicited on cross-examination of Ehlers at trial?
It was absolutely, Your Honor, covered at cross-examination. And further,
was it brought out on direct that it had to have been human, that malware or some sort of virus could not account for these fragments found on the...
Well, Detective Ehlers did not say that it could not.
Okay.
Detective Ehlers said that based upon the evidence that he had and based upon looking at this case, he did not believe that those remnant files got there through any other way except for through human interaction.
So your point would be that in this case, if anything, the defense had better expert disclosure by virtue of the notice combined with the prelim than the defendant did in Perez in terms of the notice itself. But could you comment on Mr. Westbrook's argument that the Perez issue was more collateral and this was so essential he should have been allowed to late designate a rebuttal expert?
Well, I don't think that in Perez and saying that grooming is just a motive, I don't think that it only goes to motive. I think that in those type of cases, grooming goes towards showing that an individual, what their behavior is doing in order to lead to the ultimate crimes that they're charged with. And in this case, I think that the evidence of the human user was part of the state's case. It wasn't the only thing, but it had to do with an opinion that a human user used it. And I also clarify that Detective Ehlers never said it was the appellant who was the person who actually deleted it. It was simply his belief that it was a human user. And Justice Pickering, you also asked about the reports from appellant's counsel a moment ago. I'd like to point out, and this happened at trial, that Detective Ayers testified that when they do an examination, they actually take the entire hard drive and make a copy of it. So the entire hard drive is available for an expert, such as in this case, the defense expert, had the opportunity, went and viewed the actual computer. The reason that they do this is so that the dates and whatnot can't be changed. But the fact of the matter is there is an entire report. And when you use the term report, we oftentimes think that it's a report generated with opinions given in it. But in this particular report, the detectives put very technical data. It's not them opining as to every single possibility that could be in that computer. It's simply, these are the dates, these are the images, this is the information. And they drew reasonable inferences through those dates and information. There was, and in saying that, there was a report that they had which had the thumbnails of the child pornography on it. It had those dates. But in addition to that, they also had the actual hard drive which the detectives had looked at and didn't put every single piece of information in there, but certainly it had to do with their investigation. So when appellant was concerned that there isn't a report that says this, there wouldn't necessarily be a report that says this, and that's what Detective Ayers tried to describe was, this is an entire hard drive. It would be impossible, literally, to put every single potential piece of information from that hard drive onto a piece of paper. And so what Detective Ayers did was took the crucial elements, put them onto the piece of paper, but he also brought his laptop, which the record's also clear as well, because he needed to possibly refer to additional things that weren't necessarily written verbatim in the report. So continually, when you read Detective Ayler's testimony, he says, no, not in a written report, because he oftentimes is referring to the actual computer hard drive.
Okay, because that is confusing in this record.
And I agree with that. And that was something that I went back and looked at as well. But that's why Detective Ayler was having trouble saying, well, I didn't write down every possible piece of consequence.
So, counsel, let's talk about the images. You brought up the word or used the term images. Are you going to talk about, although Mr. Westbrook didn't get too much time to do so, you can talk about the statute 207.30 and how we should interpret that?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that, as we put in our brief, it makes sense that the legislature, as well as the plain language, it says any pornographic image, should be punished under the statute. As we noted, this is different from Wilson v. State. This is not about production. And seemingly from the Wilson decision, if an individual had produced on separate days and separate occasions, that would have been more than one count of production as well. Here we have multiple images of child pornography, each one being a separate victim, although I know that they did not have to testify in the court and wouldn't necessarily have to testify. Each one represents an individual child that has been harmed by the making of that photograph. And I think that just as a person can be charged with stealing multiple things, and a person can also be charged with possessing, or a person could even be charged with possessing stolen property, multiple different pieces of property. And I think the same would apply here. These are separate victims. This is not the same victim either. And I think that based upon that, it makes sense that the legislature would wish to prevent a person from owning one piece of pornography when it relates to a child, or more than that.
So you would do the, you would interpret the statute to be a per victim in the portrayal? That would be the unit of prosecution?
I think it's per image.
So you would say if I had a video, 5 minutes of a series of, I mean, the way a video is composed, that could be however many still frames there are in that video?
Well, I think in Wilson v. State, that was the issue that they had was...
That's production of...
That was production and that wouldn't essentially be, but I believe...
But possession of this vision... Stay with me on this hypothetical. Possession of pornography with a child in it, any film, any image, if you have a video, it's a series of still images put together at such a speed that it looks to be moving, right?
I agree.
And so, if that's a series of stills, is that umpteen images of...
I think it would depend, Your Honor, on how those images have been kept and stored as well. If it were one unit of a video, I think that it would be unjust to then, for the state, for instance, to splice up the video to try to get more counts. But so that would be one unit, is the video. But in terms of taking a picture, I think the legislature wants to prevent any type of child pornography from being taken. So I think that there's a difference between taking a video and trying to make more counts versus seeing what's actually on a computer or what someone possesses and charging pornography that way.
How did the federal courts handle the situation?
Your Honor, I'm not entirely sure, to be frank with you, how they treat this.
What about other states? California seems to have gone in the direction that your computer seized and there's a bunch of pictures on it, but that's one offense.
Well, Your Honor, California is the only one I know that was briefed in this, as you point out. I'm not sure how the other states approach it, but that seems to be a legislative question on how the statute would be written then. Because here, I think
that is what what unit of prosecution is statutory construction, essentially.
Sure. And I think the statute here is clear on it, but I can't attest to other states other than obviously California that was briefed here.
Was anything asked at the legislature when they passed this as to this particular type of hypothetical? Numerous pictures versus one count versus 15 counts?
I can only cite to what we have in our brief, which I know says that it talks about the importance, which I think everyone agrees with, the importance of trying to prevent child pornography, but I'm very familiar with the Senate bill that started it and talked about the importance of preventing this from happening.
So if a defendant had two stills of the same child in the same session, the same pornographic production, and it had been made into a video but spliced into stills or re-imaged into stills, you would then say those were two counts if the defendant had them as two stills. But if the defendant kept it in video form, you would say it was one?
I think there is a distinction to be drawn there, Your Honor. And the reason
you think that's supported by the statutory text?
It says, well, I do, because it says any pornographic material. So I think in that case, and this is a little bit of conjecture on my part, but I would believe that the problem is with child pornography, the issue is it being distributed to other places as well. So if an individual takes a video and then wishes to splice it up into a lot of different pieces, those pieces now could be disseminated to other parts as
and
well.
And victimize the child repeatedly.
Exactly, Your Honor. Versus one piece of evidence versus making it multiple ones. I think there is a distinction to be drawn.
What about the rule of lenity? I mean, if the statute's genuinely ambiguous on this, would you agree with me that there's a place for that rule to apply in determining unit of prosecution?
Your Honor, to me at least, this statute doesn't seem ambiguous.
Okay.
So I think that the statute is clear on what it wishes to prosecute, the unit of prosecution, and I don't see an ambiguity there personally. If there are no other questions, I thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chandler, Mr. Westford.
Your Honor, I believe that this has already been covered, and it's been covered in the Wilson case specifically. It's a statutory range, and this statute is in the range. If the court wants to go outside, then California is the proper place to go. The state, I made this while I was sitting here this morning. I'm sure everyone's made a flip book before. Draw a picture and succession of images, and then when you flip the book, it becomes a little cartoon, right? You get a moving picture. This is one count. What the state is arguing, and if you adopt their position, would mean that if I take the pages off of this and I put it down, the manner of storage, now all of a sudden it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, etc. Every page equals another count. That is an absurd result. It's certainly not what was intended by the statute, and it certainly is against our current case law and the way California is moving.
What do you do with the argument, though, that the child is the victim, and to the extent there are different children portrayed in different images that may be collected on a single computer, that you have, in essence, multiple victims.
Then we look at instances of possession and production. The state can go into a case and prove that this child pornography features this person. It was downloaded on October 1st, 2007. This completely different image was downloaded featuring a different person on October 19th, 2008. Two instances of possession, two different victims, two different pictures. That can happen. But what happened in this case was a group of images, while only one instance of possession was established, that's the day that they were taken from the home. There was no proof that these were separate victims because that was not part of this case. There was a stipulation that it's child pornography. So for the state to say that these were separate victims with no evidence, I think is, I won't say disingenuous because I know he believes that, but the fact is it wasn't part of this case.
Didn't the stipulation include providing to the jury the actual copies of the images, and was that done?
It did, and it was. They had copies of the images, however they were told.
So those images are part of this record?
Yes, they are, Your Honor.
And are those images of different children?
I can't tell you. I don't know, Your Honor, because I don't have the identities of the individuals that were established. Furthermore, the ones that were used in this case, which kind of brings us to the bad acts issue, which you didn't really touch on very much, were the ones that were identified by some FBI tag as child pornography. The rest of them weren't, despite the fact that the 56 images were allowed to be talked about without a Petrocelli hearing.
The indictment makes a, or the information makes, gives a date range on the possession. Can you comment on what that signifies? I mean, it seems to me he was, the date they seized the images would be the date of the possession, but this seems to be worded differently.
I think it's worded differently because they're guessing, Your Honor. They have no idea. They were not able to establish what the download date was. There was a lot of expert testimony, which a lot of it we would have liked to have rebutted, regarding download dates and the definition of, the various terms for accessing files versus modifying files, file origination dates. But they didn't try, it wasn't an element of their case, to show when these were downloaded and when they were obtained. In that situation, it's a possibility that you could have multiple counts. In this situation, it was treated as a group. They didn't have individual proof for individual images. They were able to prosecute it as a group, but then when it comes to conviction, they want to separate it into 15 parts. Group evidence for group images found at one time is one charge. In closing, if I may, I'd like to address what Justice Sata said. Putting no evidence on a slide and then arguing consistently, there's no evidence of this and there's no evidence of that in regards to the defense case, to me is so much worse than doing something that this court has overturned now, I believe, two times, which is putting guilty on a slide and opening argument. Because when you put no evidence, what you're doing is you're subverting the burden of proof and the entire foundation of our judicial system. That's what happened in that rebuttal. That's what I objected to numerous times, and that's what that slide means. No evidence means they didn't show you any evidence. And ironically, we did want to show some evidence. We wanted to have an expert testify, but the state successfully denied us our ability to do that. So we didn't have the expert we wanted, and the state sat up there and talked about how there was no evidence in the closing argument. That killed this case. The burden was shifted. The jury made it very clear that they were confused by the misstatements of evidence. We have that in the record. This was not a fair trial. If there are any other questions, I'd like to address them, but if not, I appreciate your time this morning.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Westbrook, Mr. Chen, for your excellent arguments today and your briefing. The matter will stand submitted, and the court will be